Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Connie Boland. I am the founder and the coordinator now of Warbirds in Review. Have a wonderful team of professionals here on the cameras in the control room. And then, of course, Kyle Guyatt is the lady who keeps us all straight. This is our 23rd year. Hard to believe that that idea. Thank you. It is successful because all of you enjoy it and show up every year. We are successful and have been able to elevate to the level of production that you see here today and that we're streaming worldwide because of the support of Scotts Miracle-Gro Company. And today, one of our guests is Jim Hagedorn, CEO of Scotts Miracle-Gro Company. Without Jim's support and the support of Scotts Miracle-Gro, we would not be able to do this. Without the support of Ron and Diane Fagan Fighters World War II Museum in Granite Falls, we would not have this production facility, this really nice building here that we have today to work from. Today's presentation is very, very special to me. The gentleman who will be out here very shortly is now, we've called him Colonel Anderson forever, but in January he was promoted to Brigadier General, Bud Anderson. Thank you. So Bud Anderson will be here today, as he has been in Warbirds in Review for the last 23 years. Thank you. I'm very pleased to say that all of the gentlemen who will be out here in this program have been very dear friends of mine for many, many years. And of course, Bud, probably the longest, although Ray Fowler is part of this presentation today. I knew Ray when he was just a kid, showed up in a T-34 one day, and you go, wow, this kid's flying this airplane. Well, Ray is now one of the most accomplished warbird pilots in the industry, but it's not about them really today so much as it is about General Bud Anderson and the Old Crow aircraft. I'm going to take an extra few minutes here and introduce you to John Dibbs, who is promoting a program that Bud is very, very pleased to be a part of. So, Dibbs, I'm going to give you just a few minutes because it's all about Bud. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dibbsy.
Thank you very much, Connie. Yeah, very nice to be here. Thank you. It's great to be here at Oshkosh and especially here at Warbirds in Review, who do so much to keep warbirds flying and the history alive. And that's why I'm a filmmaker, and we are actually making a feature documentary about the P-51, which is called American Warhorse. We've interviewed 18 veterans who flew P-51s, and actually General Anderson is working with us on the film. He's an executive producer on the film, and part of our thinking is, why make a film about the greatest generation when you can make a film with the greatest generation? And so, indeed. And so Bud has been magnificent. He's working on the air-to-air sections with us, and we're using real aircraft to illustrate their story. So all the air-to-air will be real and based around their interview. So it'll be a very exciting, groundbreaking film. And to that end, I'd like to introduce you to the team that is also behind the film. Firstly, there's Stephen Moth. Stephen worked on such epics as Dunkirk, Bond movies, and Mission Impossible, and he's our aerial coordinator on the film.
Yeah, thanks, Dibbsy, and good to be here. Thanks for having us. I'm aerial coordinator for American Warhorse, and I see it as my job to put each one of you guys in the cockpit to get as close as we possibly can to the action. As Dibbsy said, our aim is to do everything for real, and not just track these aeroplanes in a boring fashion, but really move around and get into the action. We've got some good technology. We've got a good camera platform that Punch will just give you a rundown on, but I can't wait for you guys to see it. It's going to be a year or two in the making, but hopefully you'll enjoy it. I look forward to coming back and hearing your thoughts. Thanks, everyone.
Folks, thanks for having us out here. I'm excited about this film to try and show people what Bud saw. We talked about this before when we were initial production. A gunnery solution is a gunnery solution. A turn circle is a turn circle. I flew in the Air Force and more modern fighters, but what they did in 1915, they did in 1944, we do 2023. And we want to show that thread and we want to show it accurately. I want to thank Rod Allison from XP Services. He's helping us build the platforms. But we want to show you accurately what he went through, what his brothers went through, and make sure that you are able to truly appreciate what they went through. I'd like to introduce the brains of the operation. This is Pam Dibbs, and she's one of our executive producers.
Thanks, Punch. And he's not going to tell you that he's an ex-F-16 and ex-F-22 pilot, but you won't ever hear that from him. So I get asked the question a lot, when are we going to see this film? When's it coming out? And I'm sure you will have that burning question too. And that has a lot to do with the finances, like any other project. And we have done an amazing job. We have nearly raised all of the money for this film. And we're doing it in an unusual way, where we're actually raising all of the financing before we do the rest of the production and the big aerial unit in the spring. And so we're looking for that one final investor. So if anyone is interested in being involved in the film, please come and talk to me. And we will be really happy to be launching the film at EAA Air Venture. So we'll keep you posted.
Thank you, Dibbsy, for being here. That's going to be a wonderful, wonderful show. Just on the spur of the moment, as Bud was saying that, I wanted to introduce you to James Edward Anderson. Thanks, Jim.
All right.
And ladies and gentlemen, now coming from your left, my right, behind the Old Crow B model, is General C.E. Bud Anderson. And with General Anderson is Jack Roush, no stranger to many of you either. So, Jim's watching for you, Ed. Yeah, if you'll back up a little bit, right on the center of that Scott's logo. Sorry to cover up that Scott's logo, Jim, but here we go.
Just back it up into Roush's airplane.
Yeah, it's okay.
Don't worry about it.
For those of you who couldn't hear, he said, back it up into Roush's airplane. Okay, I think that's good. How are we doing with the cameras here? We're good? Good. Okay. Very good. And our driver here, my staff member, happens to be Brigadier General Ed McElhenney, retired Kansas Air National Guard. Ed is the moderator for many of the programs, but for this one, he's just our helper here. Also over here, who says we should back into Roush's airplane, is Jim Hagedorn. Jim Hagedorn owns the D model Old Crow. And Ray, if you want to come over to this is Ray Fowler. I mentioned earlier, Ray has been very involved with the Old Crow airplanes, flies them every chance he gets, and is.
Yeah. So, it's a hard act to follow.
Yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm the moderator for this program because I am good friends with all of these people. I am fortunate enough that Jack and Jim have offered me for many years to fly their airplanes. So, for that, I thank you guys. But more importantly, General Anderson has been very close and a big part of our family for a long time. My late husband, Ed Boland, was very close to all these people as well. So for this 23rd year and you being here on this 23rd, I'd like to somewhat dedicate this to Ed Boland, who was a huge supporter for all of us. So thank you. And I'll have Mr. Hagedorn lead us off here,
okay,
if you will.
Does this thing work? Oh, it does. Hey, everybody. Hey, drink fluids. It is blistering out there. I know you guys have been out there a long time waiting to hear him, a real fighter pilot. So I'll be quick. First, I want to like thank all you guys for coming out. This is why I think we do Oshkosh. On the selfish side, you know, I would say for those of us who fly warbirds today, Oshkosh is the place where we can come and fly formations together. Really, the only place we can do it. So we, you know, we have a lot of fun here. When I went in the military, where I served Air Force for 7 years, flying F-16s, you know, people say, thank you for your service. And honestly, I think most fighter pilots just enjoy the craft. You know, most people just get out of college and somebody hands you an F-16. It's a pretty good job, you know. So, was I disrespecting the flag?
Jack was. I didn't ever clean shot at you.
Roush is going to have a great stories for you guys. I can tell you that. I want to talk just a little bit about the quest of becoming a fighter pilot. And I'm going to tell you the story of my first check ride, okay, in the Air Force. Now, if you don't want to bust a check ride, because you'll end up flying a bomber or cargo plane or something. And so if to be a fighter pilot, you got to be sort of near the top of your class. And this is my first check ride in the T-37. It's called the contact check ride, like VFR contact. You know, I think what everybody told you is, you know, you get all pumped up for you're out there with a standards and evaluations pilot. And so we go out there, and if you had your stuff together, your act together, and everything was going well, part of the thing is you would say to the instructor who was the evaluator, sir, I have like 300 or 400 extra pounds of fuel. Would you like to fly? And usually if you were doing well, they would say, yes, I would like to fly. And then they grab the stick and do whatever they do. So everything had been going really well. All I had left was a full stop landing. That was all I had left on the check ride, was just land and don't crash. So I said, sir, I have extra gas. Would you like to fly? He says, yes. And he grabs the stick, and he's like a C-130 driver in real life before he became an instructor at Columbus Air Force Base. And he pulls the airplane up, and he climbs, and then he dives down. And you don't wear a G-suit in a T-37, and it's like a 6.5G airplane, something like that. And he's pointing the thing down at some town in Mississippi, and he's shaking the stick and making machine gun noises. Now, see, the Air Force fighter pilots never grow up, you know. So he's down there, and he's making the gun noises, and he says, we're going to pull up. Prepare to pull some Gs. And I was just enjoying the ride. And as he starts pulling, I start to lose my vision. And your vision, when you have a loss of consciousness, your vision goes first. And he's pulling up, and you're supposed to do this M1 maneuver, they call it. I don't know if they called it like when. But it's like if like you're trying to like on the toilet squeeze hard and make your face red, it's kind of like that. And it keeps the blood up in your head where you want to have some pressure to feed your eyes and your brain. And I said, oh, shit, I better do the M1 maneuver. And I take, you know, do my squeeze thing. And the next thing I know, I am waking up from after losing consciousness in a vertical aileron roll. And if you wake up in an airplane after a G-induced loss of consciousness, you don't really know what's happening. It's like you woke up in bed, except you're like in an airplane, you know? And so I don't know what to do, except they would always tell you if you completely lose your orientation, grab the controls, neutralize them, and do like an, you know, on all axes, including pitch. And it's a like unloaded recovery. So I look over and it's obvious to me all of a sudden that I'm like on a goddamn check ride. So I neutralize, I said, and I look over, just sit side by side in a T-37. And I said, sir, I'm completely disoriented. I'm doing an unloaded recovery. Which point he like grabs my mask and says, oh, Hagenorn, you know, like you were unconscious. And when you go unconscious, you go into these tremors. So you do like, he called it the funky chicken. So I'm like doing the funky chicken. And he says, take me back to Columbus. Now, I think technically if you lose consciousness, it's a physiological incident. So I think you're technically supposed to like declare an emergency. And this is my first check ride in the Air Force. I cannot screw this one up. So I'm really worried that he's going to say, you know, we should declare an emergency. He doesn't say anything. We come back in. I'm expecting the ambulances to be on the side of the runway. Nothing. You know, we come and land. Nothing. He says, let's go back to stand eval, standards and evaluation. Let's go back to stand eval for debrief. And I haven't even done the oral exam yet. So, you know, usually people would have like an hour and a half oral exam, and then you talk about the flight and what went right, what didn't go right. And just a little bit on the Air Force. You know, the debriefs on an Air Force are probably as long as the flights. So you really talk about what went right. Every single flight, there's a big evaluation what happens. So, like, we get into stand eval, and he says, you know what? Go get a Coke. You know, it's hot down there in Mississippi. He says, go get a Coke. Come back in 10 minutes. We're going to talk about this. This has got to be bad news for me. I come back in, and 10 minutes later, and he looks at me and says, Hagedorn, that was an outstanding check ride. Any questions? Not even an oral exam. I just, no. Walk back outside, told everybody, unbelievable. I can't believe this. So, I, you know, that was my quest. And so my beginning, like my first week of T-38s, which is the second half of pilot training in the Air Force, a really neat Northrop supersonic. It's a trainer, but it was kind of like the F-5 fighter. It's just a beautiful airplane to fly. We get into class there, and this guy who's our flight commander, this major A-10 guy, and he says, here's how it's going to work, folks. Everybody who wants to kill people, I want you to sit in this side of the room. Everybody who wants to fly the killer's toilet paper, you sit on that side, which was like cargo guys and crewed airplanes. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I kind of wanted to be an airline pilot. So I didn't know what to do. Like, and so he doesn't ask me till the end. And then he just looks at me. And this is honestly how I became a fighter pilot. He looked at me and said, so Hagedorn, what's it going to be? And I said, kill people, sir. And that was it. Now, just a little bit of introduction here, because I've said it before. Bud Anderson is a real fighter pilot. You know, and if we can eke some really cool stories out of Bud about his experiences in World War II, where, you know, Bud probably had more experience flying because he'd had some stateside tours before he went over and he went to gunnery school. So he's going to tell us some cool stuff, and he's a real fighter pilot. Ray Fowler is also a real fighter pilot. Ray, how many deployments have you done?
I've done 5 deployments so far.
So this dude is a friend of mine. I married him and his wife, and that was a great pleasure of mine. And he's also a great fighter pilot. And when we talked about how to do this, it was like maybe Ray can talk about flying the Mustang and what we do.
Okay, so this is my show, Jim. I know it's your show, but it's my show. So I have made the command decision that we should ask General Anderson. It's awfully hot out here, so I would like to get Bud going here, and I know the people would love to hear from Bud. I mean, Ray has some really cool and interesting stories, Afghanistan deployments and warbird flying. But, Ray, what's your favorite story? Maybe Bud's first mission you want to ask Bud about?
I think I do. So obviously, I will say, and this goes back 25 years. Bud has been so gracious to be a part of all of us here. And because of Connie, he was actually going to come speak at my Air Force graduation 25 years ago, which is just an unbelievable to have a Triple Ace come and speak for us. But we are so thrilled that you're here this year. And I know many people have already heard this story before, but I love the story of your first kill. And I understand that there were people in the unit that were brand new and they had their first kill. And you were still the ops officer, but did not have a single kill, which had to be very frustrating to you that the other guys had came in and got their first confirmed, but you were still waiting for your first kill. So would you be willing to share your story for your first kill?
Sure. Thank you. I was promoted to the operations officer very shortly after I got into combat because I was one of the original pilots in the 363rd Fighter Squadron. And we were starting to get kills, and, you know, Bud Anderson, the hottest pilot in the squadron, I don't have a kill. So I'm kind of wondering, good God, what's the matter with me? Why didn't I get, you know, I just never in the right position and all this stuff. And finally, one day, I get into a dogfight with a ME-109 down fairly low where they perform the best against a Mustang. And this guy's giving me a hard time. And I said, Christ's sake, what's the matter with me? You know, and so I really dug in, and we're just doing concentric circuits, we're circling, and neither one's getting a very good chance of shooting. Too high of a G. And when you're down low, and you're pulling a high G, you're banked up like this, and you can't see underneath your wing. And if you pull enough lead, you know, it's like a shotgun. You got to get ahead of him and keep tracking and fire. You're pulling all this G, and you can't see your target. And so I'm trying everything I know about fighting. I haven't gotten a kill yet. And so I said, God dang it, I'm gonna do something unusual. I'm gonna pull through him smoothly as I can. Estimate the lead. Now I can't see him. Estimate the lead, fire, and when he comes through, I'll see if I get a lucky shot. So we come around again, and I pick him up, track him, pull through him very smoothly. Now I don't see him. And then I fire a shot. He comes out into view, and he's streaming coolant. Ah, hot dog, I got him. My first one. And I'm sitting in the cockpit there, patting myself on the back, and all of a sudden I realize there's somebody out of there on my wing, very close. Following me. And so I straighten out and I see it's John England, a pilot from another squadron, who's already got a couple of kills. And I think, dang, did he shoot that thing out from under me? And I said, I knew it was a very lucky kill if I got a kill. And dang, maybe I didn't kill it. Maybe it was Johnny England sitting back here and he had gotten the shot in. And clobbered him because I hadn't seen him. So I roll out, and Johnny pulls up on my wing, and he was down low, and he had his mask off, and he was grinning like a you-know-what. And I thought for a minute, dang, did he shoot that thing out from under me? I knew it was a very lucky shot that I had. And so by the time I got home, I questioned whether I had really shot that airplane down because it was out of sight and all that. And I thought maybe Johnny England was back here and pulled the shot off and then came up on my wing. Because the guy pulled right up and bailed out immediately after he was streaming so badly with coolant. And I spent the rest of the flight home questioning whether I had really shot that guy down. It had to be a very, very lucky shot. And so by the time I got home, we had our squadron briefing debrief. And then we go to the intelligence officer and file a claim. If you thought you got a kill, and see what happens. And so I told him to hang on to it. I got to go see a pilot from a different squadron and verify the kill. I was going to ask Johnny England, who got the kill, you or me? And I didn't actually see him shoot, but I knew my shot had to be the luckiest one in the world. And so I'm driving down the road to the officers' club where we all used to go right after a mission. And they talked to the other pilots. The whole group would be there, not just the squadron. So John England would be there. So I'm going on my way down there to go to the club. I'm thinking, well, how the hell am I going to bring this up? You know, I'm going to say, hey, did you shoot that thing out the front of me? And I said, I'll just go in and wing it. So I went in the club, and he's the first guy I see across the room, and he's a bar facing the front door. And he comes running over to me, and he says, Andy, he says, that was the greatest, best shot I've ever seen. You got that sucker out there about 60 degrees angle off. I said, oh, Johnny, lucky shot. I rushed to the telephone to claim my first kill.
We need a new driver.
Bud, that's operator error. Bud, that's incredible. I was going to ask you because I didn't really have a chance to. So many of you people may not know, Bud flew his last P-51 ride in his 80s, and I believe it was here at Oshkosh. Was your last flight here at Oshkosh, or did you fly a P-51 after Oshkosh? When was your last P-51 flight, and how old were you?
I think that had to be it.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But last year, we had the opportunity to take Bud again at 100 years old. So me and Jim were his wingman, and we got in. Jack was gracious enough to let us for me to fly the B model, but he climbed into another P-51, a TF Mustang, and flew it last year. So how was your experience flying the P-51 last year? Was that a good time?
Yeah, I had a good time.
That's incredible.
It's hard not to have a good time in a Mustang. It's always a good time in a Mustang, right? Ray, let's go back to you and your history, and then we'll bring Mr. Roush in to say thank you once again for you and I having the opportunities that we've had in the Warbird community. So tell us a little bit about Ray Fowler.
The
airplanes, whichever one.
Well, I think I'll talk more about airplanes and Ray Fowler. Again, I've been very blessed to get to fly a lot of cool airplanes, but my background's civilian and military, so I am still in the Air National Guard. I flew F-16s just like Jim did, so we're just sunsetting our F-16s now, and I fly for Delta Airlines, which is what my day job is. But really, to have the opportunity for all these years to come out and get to, I can tell you, you never look bad when you're standing next to a triple ace or Jack Roush. So it's pretty very unique. And Jim, you're okay too to stand next to on occasion. But certainly these two here. It's been a very much a blessing. Again, this program is so important and the history is so important. So, again, this is a great turnout, and the Warbirds in Review has been so successful. And I think Connie, really the reason I get to fly Warbirds is it started with Connie. So she's, for some reason, I think she had some confidence I could fly airplanes because she's the one that talked these two into letting me fly theirs, which was kind of nice. But
it was kind of cool. I introduced Ray to Jim Hagedorn many, many years ago now. And I think it was like 2 years that Jim said, "Hey, dude, hey, get the dude to come up here and fly my airplane."
I don't think I told Jim this, but the worst landing I've ever had in a P-51 was in his airplane when I took it into Columbus. And had he seen my landing, I don't think he would have ever let me fly one again. But thank God.
Hold on. Oh, okay, here we go.
Connie also geared up my airplane.
Hey, whoa, wait a minute. Wait a minute. That was the airplane you bought from Roush, and he said no damage history. Right?
And not a gear up. But,
it was not truly. It was kind of sort of one gear up, but that's another story. And to say Jack Roush, I called Jack on the phone after, I'm sitting out here on the edge of the runway. One gear came down, the other one did not, and I landed the airplane. I just flew the airplane, did what I had to do. Called Jack on the phone, and I said, "Jack, I'm okay, and the airplane will probably fly again." Jack says to me, "I'm sorry, I gave you a faulty piece of equipment." He had no idea if I had totally messed up or if it truly was mechanical, but that's the kind of man he is. So, Jack Roush, for this airplane, which is the one that kind of came in here crippled, you got it back within a couple of months, but a lot of these P-51s out here would not be flying, and certainly the engines would not be running as well as they do if it weren't for Jack Roush and his interest in what we do and his abilities and the team he has behind him back at Roush Aviation. So, Jack, would you like to tell us a little bit about Roush Aviation?
I'd love to have a chance to tell you some things about Jim Hagedorn and about the airplanes and about the job they did in World War II, but I want to start off and tell you about Jim as a fighter pilot. He was a check pilot for the F-16. Pilots, you'd have no greater fear than to have Jim park his airplane on your ramp and say, "Okay, let's go for a ride." I had a situation similar to that when I met Jim. I didn't know what Jim was doing. I knew he was an executive with Scotts. And they were interested in doing some business with me with my NASCAR program. And so he came to see me. We had a couple of his business people. I went to the hangar and met him coming in. I thought we'd go off into a banquet room someplace and sit down and haggle. And he said, walked by the Mustang. And he says, "Has that got two seats in it?" I says, "Yeah, it does, Jim." He says, "Let's go for a ride." Posed me a real difficult problem. Do I want to go out and make Jim Hagedorn sick flying the back seat of a Mustang that can pull 6 G's, or should I go out and give him a sissy ride and have him think that I didn't have the right stuff? So I thought about it for a minute. I says, Hagedorn, you're on your own. So I had a habit of beating up all the grass strips in the area, and we went out and found three or four of them. And went vertical and didn't do a roll on the ground, but we went vertical and did some things. I told him, I said, Jim, there's one more airport out here that makes competition airplanes for aerobatics. I said, if I find it, it's a small runway, but I said, we'll make a pass over it. And I looked for it, and I couldn't find it, and I'm flying at 3,000 feet. And I tell him, I said, we're going to go back because I can't find it. And as I saw that, as I said that, I had something out of my corner of my eye. There it was. So I pitched over 3,000 feet, went vertical down, put the wings in at about a 30-degree angle from flat, and went through a hole that was too small for a Mustang. And went back vertical again. Jim didn't say a word. He just went back to the hangar, and I thought, I've really screwed up. He's probably going to miss, and I sat in the back seat of my airplane. And he got out of the airplane, and his guys were still there. They're waiting on him to come back before they did the haggling. And he slipped off the part of the ring that you walk on if you don't want to damage the airplane. Stood in the middle of the wing, spread his legs apart, put his arms on his hips, and says, "Boys, I've flown behind the tanker in F-16 three times." He says, "I broke the sound barrier over a whorehouse in Babcock." But he says, "I've never been that fast that close to the ground."
All right. Well, I got to correct a little bit. I don't know this guy, but the chance to fly in the backseat of a Mustang was important. And, you know, there's no controls in the back of these two airplanes. And we were in the Glamorous Glennis airplane, now the Gentleman Jim airplane. And we... all I know is we're just diving on some strip, and the VNE, you know, the max speed is about 500 miles an hour.
The statute of limitations has run out on this.
Yeah, there's no FAA people here,
okay.
Right?
All right.
We are below the tree line with the airspeed pegged. This is the NASCAR guy. And so I just said, we got in the ground. I said, I want to buy one of your airplanes. It was that much fun. So, and you know, the thing about Jack was not military. I think he was in his 40s when he learned how to fly.
50.
And, yeah. And Jack's not flying Mustangs, but I'll tell you what, a fabulous Mustang driver.
We had a good time. He said that he had a thought when they were going vertical and headed toward the ground. He says, "I don't know this guy. I just met him. I wonder what he's going to do next." And we got back okay. But Jim Hagedorn is a great friend, and he's promoted the Warbirds in Review here. And a lot of what we're able to do, we wouldn't be able to do without Scott's and without Jim's participation. Give Jim a round of applause.
Yes.
And Jim, that... Jack, that ride cost Jim a lot of money, didn't it? So since he ended up buying a Mustang and supporting the program and still flying today, but Jack flew the P-51 to, how many races did you take the P-51? Most people probably didn't know that was his daily driver for years, so in and out of the races with a Mustang is pretty cool.
Yeah, I enjoyed driving it to work when I could, and we had a big time putting this airplane together. When Jim said he wanted to buy an airplane, I had two that were in construction, the B model, the green airplane, and the Gentleman Jim that I assembled from parts. And but I thought I'd take a chance on the 10-year-old restoration and let him have that if he wanted to. I made him wait for a year. I had an agreement with him that he had to support Bud Anderson and what we're doing here at EAA, and it couldn't change the appearance of the airplane, which he's the biggest fan of what we're doing, and we couldn't do it without him.
You know, Jack is... So Jack interviews me, you know, because I'm flying a piece of history. And comes to my office, and he makes me sign a contract that I can never change the name of the airplane from Old Crow. And I mean, I wouldn't want to. But what he didn't tell me is he was building the Faux Crow out of a bunch of parts. And he told me, I'll sell you the Glamour Glennis, the newer airplane. He said, I'll sell you that. Then he calls me and says, no, I can't sell you that. I'm going to sell you the older one, which is I'm real happy with. I want to sell you the Crow because I'm going to keep the Glamorous Glennis airplane, the Gentleman Jim airplane now. And he interviewed me, and then he said, you can't. I'm not going to sell it to you until you have 100 hours of time and heavy tailwheels. And he lent me his SNJ, which is a T6, Navy T6. And, you know, it had no navigation gear in it except like a little GPS that was Velcro to the glare shield, which when he gave me the airplane, he took the GPS, which wasn't a big deal flying around Columbus. But when I had to bring the airplane home when I had my 100 hours, like I had a old school sectional map, like with lines drawn on it, like back in the day. And if any of you flown a T6, if you drop something in a T6, there's no floor. It just goes right down to the skin, like 6 feet away. So I'm flying up there, and it's under map is under my leg, and I lift my leg up, and the map falls down. Now I have no map. So I'm lost going up to Detroit to return his airplane. And who comes out of the sun in a P-51 and jumps me? This guy.
I knew your plan. I knew how to get there and see you. It was my T-60 was flying. I was flying the airplane that he was buying, which I'd had for 10 years, so I was in control of everything that day. It was a good deal. I want to take a minute and talk about what was happening in the war and World War II. World War I ended poorly. They had the despots and the heads of state that were not subject to capitalism and to democracy in charge of Western Europe. Plus Russia, plus China, and they didn't get along, and so the French had the biggest load. We were afraid the Germans were going to beat the English, and so we sent over. It was 5 year war. There was 2 years that we spent involved. The French lost 6 million people. The U.S. lost 53,000. And the British lost 800,000. The President Woodrow Wilson spent a year trying to talk the Europeans in to go easy on the German people. They wouldn't do it. They wanted reparations that would make them whole for the losses that they had during the war. And so they put a high tax on the Germans and left it perfect for somebody like Hitler to come in and set up another world war. The World War II was 6 years. We spent 4 years in that. There were our casualties were 410,000. The Russians' casualties were 8.7 million, and they had 19 million civilian casualties. So the Russians had reasons to want high payments from the Germans as well. The Americans were not in the war until Germany declared war after Japan dropped on Pearl Harbor. The Americans were really responsible for Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor. We'd not given them oil, we'd not given them lumber, we'd not given them steel, and the colonies of colonization of the world by the West Europeans left the Japanese with no problem but to go to war for their resources. So we fought the war, and we gave Japan back their freedoms. We gave them all the oil and the steel and everything they needed. It became on the world seen as a manufacturing company, and the United States paid the price again. But all that was good since we got a booming economy after the war, and we have a chance to celebrate the contributions that Colonel Anderson or General Anderson and the other people have done to keep us free and to let us be the leaders of the free world that we are.
I want to, like, ask one question. You know, how many people have heard his quarter kill? You know, he's got a quarter kill. Have you ever heard, like, how did that happen? Your quarter when you got a quarter kill, how did that work?
Well, a quarter kill, 14 and a quarter, means that you shared your kill with three other guys. Usually you see a half where two guys share an airplane. Very seldom would you see guys share their whole flight with a kill. And this was probably right in the middle of my tours. And we were way deep in Germany. Oh, I think we'd been to Poland and we're coming home or something. And I...
Did you find a B or a D then?
Probably, I don't know. I'd have to look it up in the records.
I suspect it was a B.
Yeah, probably still a B. And incidentally, I kind of like the bee, and it's single bubble, had good or better vision than the D over here, which is a full canopy, and if it hadn't been for the four guns versus six guns, I think it would have ended up being my favorite. But you need the goddamn guns.
His ground support crew had figured out how to let the guns not jam in high G situations. And the B had the problem of jamming the guns if you're pulling a lot of G. He had that fixed on his airplane. And another very successful pilot followed him in the same airplane with the same guns.
Yeah.
I did like the fact that General Anderson said whenever his wingmen flew with him, they didn't get to shoot very often. So that was very nice of you. I'm sure they were appreciative that you shared a kill with them.
Yeah, we were coming back from Poland or someplace pretty deep where it would have been deep in Germany. And we had just had an engagement with some 109s. And they took it down to the deck. And on the way down to the deck, I see these shadow, and I couldn't see the airplane. It was camouflaged so well, and it was hazy, and I couldn't tell whether it was the U.S., a German, or a Brit, or what. And so we took care of the 109th, and then I says, "Hey, guys, did you see a shadow or anything?" And he said, no. And I said, "Well, get up here." And I put them in spread formation. And then we took off right through the middle of where I had seen those shadows disappear. And I flew for about 2 or 3 minutes. And sure enough, boom, the shadows appeared again. But you couldn't see the airplane. They were camouflaged so well. If it had been a real hazy day, I would have missed this guy. But anyway, I see it, and we come screaming up to it, and I said, "Oh, God, an old Heinkel 111, a twin-engine obsolete Battle of Britain bomber." And I said, "Oh my!" I pulled up here. He's down here, and I says, "God, this is an easy kill. I'll just slide over there and blow him out of the sky, get another kill." And then I thought a little bit about my wingman, and I said, "You know what? Why don't I give those guys a chance to shoot at this?" This soft target. So I told the guys, I said, okay, guys, get into trail formation, practice gunnery formation. And so, boy, you don't ever saw guys get in the echelon right so fast, they almost collided. They knew they were going to get to shoot. And they were so happy. So we get down there, we get lined up. Four airplane echelon right formation. Lead goes in like this, fires a burst, and then comes up here on this other side and sits. And number two comes in, fires a burst, slides over, and gets into the number two in a left-hand echelon. And you do that because you get the most shots. And if you got a stable target, non-maneuvering. And so we got an engine burning, and the guy's heading for the deck real fast. He's down low to begin with. And everybody had made a firing pass, and we were on our second bunch of passes. And he's just about ready to belly in. And so we get a couple of passes from the left-hand side again. And he's got one burning and the other one smoking really bad. They bellied it in and hit something between the left engine and the fuselage, and it tore the wing open and spread fire all over and opened up the 111, and two guys got out of it, and the one guy sitting there with his hands on his hips out in front of it looking up at us. We'll go around there like angry hornets. And one guy got out and starts running. There's no place to go. What the hell are you running for? It's just nothing but wide open, nice flat field. Not even any bushes to hide in. And I says, you dumbass, I'm going to give you a thrill. So I rolled up and came in at him low like this and flew right over the top of him and pulled up, did a roll, and went on home.
Thank you, bud.
You know, I do want to say, I guess I get, you know, we sponsor and I fly here and I'm buds with all these guys, but what a privilege it is to have Bud Anderson here. The oldest, highest count ace in the world. And Bud, I hope we get you back next year too.
Yay.
You think? I think he deserves a standing ovation, guys.
Thank you, Jim. You're absolutely right. He deserves whatever we can do for him here. Yes, sir. To all these guys here, I think, you know, by your presence and the crowd we see here, you realize that this is history, and that's what we're preserving. So now we have it recorded. And so forever and ever, people will know the Bud Anderson story and of these, the friendships that have been built around these airplanes. So the airplanes brought us, but the people keep us coming back. I've heard that before here at Oshkosh. We have a couple of minutes for questions. It's awfully hot out here, but if anybody has a question, Mary is here with a microphone. Airplane question for Bud. We'll try to keep them short. Because I know all of you are hot also. Does this mean you're leaving, Jim?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
We've had quite a few questions over to the right.
Okay, questions. Okay, David.
Are either one of these planes the actual planes that General Anderson flew in the war?
I think I can go ahead and answer that. He did not fly any of these in the war. These were... a lot of Mustangs survived because they went to the guard units at the end of the war, and that's why they were not actually overseas. There are a few airplanes around, Ray, if you want to jump in, that saw service, but neither one of these.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I will add, if you guys are camping here, at least if you hear the Mustangs that wake you up every morning, we've always done that in the morning, which is a lot of fun. So if that does not make you happy, that's not us, but if you like hearing Mustangs in the morning, we try to take off every morning at 6:15 and go fly to make sure you guys are up in the morning.
So it's the sound of freedom, fun. You know, perfect. Okay, we have another question here for Dick.
Can we ask General Anderson to tell us how old he was when he flew his last mission in World War II?
How old were you, Bud, when you flew your last mission in World War II? The famous, dropped your bombs, but just tell us how old you were, or your drop tanks, excuse
me. I told him, I guess I was 23.
You were the old guy in the squadron, weren't you?
Yeah, I think I was 23.
Wow.
Okay. And here you are. Yes, sir.
I know you flew the P-39 Aero Cobra before you flew the Mustang. What are your thoughts on that? How did you like it?
Oh, well, I hadn't flown any other kind of a fighter. That was the first one. And, you know, God damn, I'm a fighter pilot, so you don't care whether it's a T-6 or a whatever it is, you're going to fly it like a fighter. And I didn't know what a lousy airplane it was until I got to fly some other airplanes, like a P-51. And immediately we realized it was a great airplane. The P-39 was actually built for ground attack, and it was an ideal situation. It had a cannon that fired through the nose and machine guns that fired around the cannon, plus two wing guns. It didn't have very good flight characteristics. Some people said it would tumble ass over tea kettle if you tried, you know, lost control of it. I never had tumbled one, but I watched some guys rat racing over the field. I think the last guy fell out of it, and he probably thought he tumbled. But,
Okay, I'm sorry, but not to interrupt. Mary's got someone who's been patient.